in what's happening in our society is corporate universities, as your first segment, they've been complicit with the Trump team. Corporate law firms have been complicit, made all these deals saying they're going to do pro bono work, have millions of dollars for Trump. You can't do pro bono work for Trump. Pro bono work means you're representing nonprofits or individuals who cannot afford attorneys. And now you have the media conglomerates who are complicit with Trump. So it's a very dangerous situation. And it started decades ago. And FAIR was critical when Bill Clinton and the right-wing Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, behind closed doors, written by media lobbyists, did the Telecommunications Act, which allowed big media companies to get even bigger.
We have 15 seconds, Jeff.
We have.
Jeff, thank you so much for being with us. This is an issue we will, to say the least, continue to follow. Do you have another prediction, since you certainly got this one right?
Yeah, I'm sad that I believe that Jon Stewart's in trouble. And, you know, Jimmy Kimmel, his employer is Disney. He could be in trouble. You learn more from a 10-minute monologue from these comedians than you do from a month of watching the news on those channels.
Jeff Cohen, thanks so much for being with us. Co-founder of the action group RootsAction.org and co-founder of FAIR. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland, volunteer-powered community radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, where you can listen to That Vegan Show this Friday at 11 a.m. This is Melissa Lesniak, creator and host of That Vegan Show. My interview this month is with Will of Fiddler's Fungus Farm. Will fills us in about his home animal sanctuary and, of course, about mushrooms, from cooking to growing and even which ones are local. So tune in to That Vegan Show this Friday at 11 a.m., only on KBOO.
Support for KBOO comes from our members and from Metropolitan Family Services Cash Oregon, committed to improving the financial health of low to moderate income families and individuals by providing free tax preparation services. Volunteers are currently needed to support this program. All training is provided and no tax experience is necessary. More info on volunteering at cashoregon.org. Support for KBOO comes from our members and from Friends of Noise, presenting a two-day music festival for the documentary No Quiet Hours, a focus on the DIY music scene in Oregon. The festival is Friday, July 25th and Saturday, July 26th, from 5 to 9 p.m. both days, and will feature food, arts and crafts, and a lineup of 8 bands from across the region. Tickets and info at friendsofnoise.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Trump wants personal data of people who have been receiving SNAP benefits. Oregon has not agreed to hand it over yet.
Oregon Department of Transportation is facing a $350 million budget deficit. COTEC is trying to address the issue.
And in the national news, Attorney General Pam Bondi reportedly told Trump that he was mentioned in the Epstein files earlier this year. Good evening. This is KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, July 23rd, 2025. I'm Cheryl Denise.
And I'm David Chittenden. The Trump administration wants personal data on the people receiving SNAP as soon as Thursday. Officials allege that they are trying to curb fraud and waste in government spending. There rarely is any fraud in food stamps. The U.S. Department of Agriculture wants names, addresses, dates of birth, and social securities of people who received or applied for food stamps in the last 3 years. This plan ignores people's right to privacy. More than 700,000 people in Oregon receive SNAP benefits. The average monthly payment is about $300 a month. A spokesperson from Oregon's DHS told OPB that they are reviewing the USDA request for information, but they have not given an answer. USDA put out an order for this information in May when they announced that they wanted the information in order to create a, quote, national SNAP information database. The federal agency has also reported that they want to stop people who do not have legal papers from using SNAP. People who are here without legal status have never been able to access SNAP, but people who have refugee or asylum status may receive benefits currently. USDA had stopped its effort to get personal data when a group of people receiving SNAP sued the agency, saying it was a violation of privacy rights. But now they're on the hunt for data again. Alex Agday is the SNAP policy analyst and outreach coordinator at Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon. Agday told OPB that the government clearly does not need the addresses and social security numbers of those receiving SNAP to determine eligibility. Really, the only reason they might need it is to share it with law enforcement. Trump administration made a recent agreement to share Medicaid personal information with U.S. Customs and Immigration Enforcement officials. Agday says, quote, "All of this combines to an attempt by the federal government to rein in their power and be able to exercise law enforcement and immigration enforcement anywhere, anytime, against anyone," end quote. Oregon Senators Jeff Merkley and Ron Wyden joined 11 other Democrat congressional senators in sharing their concerns with the USDA. A part of the letter reads, quote, "USDA is trying to grant itself endless authority to share Americans' private information is a serious violation of government norms." In other efforts to subdue this request, Oregon Attorney Dan Rayfield has joined other attorney generals in urging USDA to revoke this request. This story was informed largely from reporting from OPB.
In the wake of the Oregon legislators' failure to pass House Bill 2025, TriMet will start making a series of budget reductions beginning this year, including service cuts to address a significant challenge of funding. The failure of the bill passing leaves many of the Oregon's transit agencies, including TriMet, without sufficient funding needed to sustain service levels in the years ahead. The absence of legislative action in June has forced TriMet to make service cuts this November and in March of next year, with additional reductions necessary in the years ahead to begin closing in on the $300 million gap between expenditures and revenue. Despite reductions, TriMet has stated they will prioritize safety, reliability, and essential maintenance, initial service cuts reducing frequencies on some bus lines, as well as adjusting MAX and bus routes. TriMet has officially stated they will reduce service on November 30th by reducing how frequent lines are during evenings and mornings, including the FX2 bus line. These planned cuts could be frozen and changes in the coming days or weeks as Governor Tina Kotex calls for a special session to address the funding for ODOT.
In hopes of avoiding cuts and finding funding for Oregon Department of Transportation, Oregon Governor Tina Kotek announced Tuesday she'll call for a special legislative session set for August 29th to address a deficit of over $350 million in the Oregon Department of Transportation budget. With supermajorities in both the Oregon House of Representatives and the Oregon Senate, Democratic lawmakers still failed to pass House Bill 2025. The governor's renewed effort is an attempt to rally the state legislature to avoid the layoff of 483 workers in the ranks of the Oregon Department of Transportation. Without this special session, ODOT would have had to make deep and painful cuts starting in the next few weeks. Democrats failed to convince Oregonians, legislative Republicans, and crucial members of their own caucus to raise taxes and fees without new road projects. Republicans also couldn't find traction for their counterproposals to fund road maintenance by cutting spending on transit, environmental initiatives, and the Transportation Department's equity work. Before the initial vote at the end of the session in late June, Oregon Senate President Rob Wagner removed Senator Mark Meek from the Transportation Committee on June 20th to boost the bill's chance of passing. However, the Democrats still did not have the votes to pass it.
Democratic Governor Tina Kotex says the failure of HB 2025 marks the largest mass layoff in the history of Oregon state government. Kotex says, quote, "These layoffs constitute an emergency in Oregon's transportation system that will hurt every part of Oregon. While we sharpened our pencils to temper the pace of layoffs from one wave into two, there will not be enough workers to provide the level of response Oregonians rely on, whether it's filling a pothole, whether it's filling a pothole or clearing a safe passage for evacuation when a fire strikes," end of quote. Republican House Minority Leader Christine Drazen said, quote, "Families are making cuts and people every day are trying to figure out how to tighten their belt. I don't want anybody to lose their job, but I don't want to assume that everything that a state agency did yesterday, that we have to do it no matter what in perpetuity," end quote. Governor Kotex asked ODOT to postpone the layoffs for 45 days. Those layoffs were originally scheduled to take effect at the end of July. In addition to the potential need to shed almost 500 state workers, ODOT will put on hold plans to close 12 road maintenance outposts around the state as well. Governor Kotex says, quote, "I am confident that lawmakers will step up next month to avert these layoffs by approving the necessary funding for the state's transportation needs. I appreciate their partnership and am eager to be on the other side of this crisis," end quote. This special session is focused on critical near-term solutions to stabilize basic functions at ODOT and local government. Democrats in recent weeks are interested in investigating a 6-cent increase to the state gas tax, an increase to auto registration and title fees, and the doubling of a tax Oregon workers pay to support public transportation for the special session. They say that would be enough to stop the ODOT layoffs and send money to city and county departments struggling with their own budget challenges.
As wildfire season in Oregon starts, there are some things that you can do to make your home more defensible. Oregon State Fire Marshal has a whole informational page about what you can do to maintain a defensible space. What is a defensible space? Defensible space is the area around your home or business, including nearby grass, trees, shrubs, and wildlands. It can help to mitigate wildfires to keep this area mowed and free of overgrown brush and dry material that could feed a fire. Maintaining this defensible space can improve safety for people and firefighters and make evacuations easier. Making this defensible space can include clearing out dried leaves and pine needles from gutters, eaves, and around your chimney. It can also help to trim lower branches, keep patios free of dry materials, and remove or trim plants and bushes that are growing directly under your eaves. The fire marshal recommends storing firewood and construction materials at least 30 feet away from houses. Oregonians can schedule a free defensible space assessment online at oregon.gov. The Oregon State Fire Marshal reminds Oregonians that planning today protects tomorrow.
The Oregon Secretary of State's office found $1.4 million in potentially wasteful payments within the Preschool Promise Program. Tobias Reed, the Secretary of State, said, quote, "As a dad, I know quality childcare is hard to find, much less afford, which is why it's frustrating when programs like this aren't delivering as much as they can," end quote. Auditors began investigating the program after receiving a tip through the government accountability hotline of potential fraud and waste. Preschool Promise exists to expand the availability of high-quality preschool options, providing grant funding to child care providers that pay for slots in preschool programs for eligible children. Much of the work the auditors focused on was managed by the Oregon Department of Education. After the program moved to the Department of Early Learning and Care in 2023, the agency took steps to strengthen the program's controls. Auditors found $1.4 million in grants paid out were deemed wasteful, and also identified $1.5 million in improper payments that didn't follow the terms of the grant agreement. A majority of the funding were in payments to providers with chronically low enrollment, with one example in which a provider was awarded funds to maintain 36 slots, but only enrolled a single child. The next year, the same provider was awarded funds for 10 slots, but only served two children. The Department of Education could have saved over $300,000 by reducing or termination of the grant. Auditors have recommended 13 changes to strengthen internal controls and detect providers who aren't in compliance with program requirements.
President Trump says Obama committed treason to skew the 2016 election results. House Speaker Mike Johnson grows frustrated with attempts to release Epstein files, and a new agreement lets the Department of Homeland Security access personal information from Centers for Medicaid and Medicare. With that story and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks. We're following our democracy in historic times.
They caught President Obama absolutely cold, Tulsi Gabbard. What they did to this country starting in 2016, but going up all the way to 2020 in the election, they tried to rig the election and they got caught. And there should be very severe consequences for that.
President Donald Trump says former President Barack Obama committed treason and should be criminally charged for allegedly meddling in the 2016 election. Deflecting questions about his ties to convicted child sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein, Trump cited information from Intelligence Director Tulsi Gabbard, arguing Obama administration officials falsely accused Russia of election interference to sway voters, but two separate investigations found Russia did work to help elect Trump. The Justice and Intelligence Agencies have also released more files on civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server. Reporters say neither release contained anything of importance. House GOP leadership is growing frustrated by members of the chamber trying to force the release of the Epstein files. Congressman Thomas Massey has been leading a coalition of lawmakers to compel a vote on the issue, but House Speaker Mike Johnson says he's skeptical of the Kentucky Republicans' motives.
Thomas Massey could have brought his discharge petition any time over the last 4.5 years. Over the last 4 years of the Biden administration, he could have done that at any time. And now he's clamoring as if there's some sort of timeline on it. It's interesting to me that he chose the election of President Trump to bring this.
House Republicans blocked two votes on a Democratic bill forcing justice to release the Epstein files last week. Johnson announced the chamber will start its August recess early, avoiding another vote on the Epstein documents. Meanwhile, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare formally agreed to share personal information with the Department of Homeland Security. That will allow ICE to find and detain immigrants nationwide, making some migrants anxious about going to the doctor. Catherine Vieira is with Connecticut's Husky for Immigrants Coalition.
What we're primarily hearing is fear from folks around, like, how safe it is to continue to see their healthcare providers, to continue to use the coverage they have access to.
She says adults tell them they're especially concerned about how this will impact their children, including those who are citizens, since many are enrolled in Medicaid. And healthcare providers say people foregoing medical care will mean working migrants will end up in the emergency room, have unpaid hospital bills, and incur family medical debt. A similar pattern was already starting in other states even before the new information sharing agreement. Immigrants' rights groups say ICE officers were recently at a mobile health clinic near Los Angeles. And Cecilia Aquino with the Latino Coalition for a Healthy California says some of their clinic partners have seen a drop in visits because people are afraid to leave their homes. She calls it a pandemic of fear.
Where folks would much rather wait for something to be an acute emergency rather than prevent because they need to protect themselves and their family.
California lets migrants enroll in Medi-Cal no matter their legal status. Under the Biden administration, promotores, navigators who speak Spanish, would specifically help people sign up and wouldn't share information with ICE. But the Trump administration reversed that policy. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on Portland Community College students and teachers fighting against cuts to programs with Street Roots Snowden intern Grace Magali. At 6, it's The Underground. Then at 7, PDX Progressive Talk Radio. Tonight's weather will be a high of 90 around now and a low of 59 degrees tonight. And tomorrow we will have a high of 85 and a low of 58. Today in 1967, a riot began in Detroit as African Americans and the city's police department were involved in violent confrontations following a police raid on an illegal drinking club. The unrest, which lasted for 5 days, is considered one of the catalysts of the militant Black Power movement. The quote of the day is from late Ozzy Osbourne, who died yesterday, Tuesday, July 22nd. He said, quote, "They say military have the so-called secret intelligence. This amount of intelligence must be very secret, since I've never seen any intelligent military person, nor have I seen any sense in the bloody, stupid wars," end quote.
Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney addressed First Nations concerns with the fast track of major housing development projects. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News. Okay. In a significant development, Ken Pugarick, the head of FEMA's Urban Search and Rescue Branch, tendered his resignation on July 21st. His decision follows escalating tensions regarding the agency's direction and delays in disaster response efforts. Sources indicate that the resignation is linked to the Department of Homeland Security's handling of aid for Texas flood victims, which has resulted in at least 135 fatalities. The delays were attributed to bureaucratic obstacles in Washington and concerns over the Trump administration's efforts to weaken FEMA. Pugarick, who has dedicated over a decade to FEMA's search and rescue operations, expressed in his resignation letter that this choice was not made lightly. He emphasized his inspiration from the dedication and courage of his colleagues in their mission to save lives amid devastation. In response to Pugarick's departure, DHS defended its fiscal policies, criticizing his resignation as laughable. A spokesperson pointed to the agency's refusal to approve a significant deployment contract without proper financial oversight as a key issue. "It is laughable that a career public employee who claims to serve the American people would choose to resign over a refusal to hastily approve a six-figure deployment contract without basic financial oversight," the spokesperson said. Secretary Kristi Noem has also faced scrutiny for her new policy requiring her approval for all grants over $100,000, which contributed to the delays in deploying critical resources during the early hours of the Texas floods. As the situation unfolds, the implication of these decisions on disaster response remain to be seen. Okay, back to National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Prime Minister Mark Carney recently held a summit with some of Canada's Indigenous leaders to address the issue of laws that allow the fast tracking of major development projects. Dan Karpinchuk has more.
Carney was trying to ease First Nations fears about the major projects law, but many said it would take more than one meeting to build consensus on Ottawa's plans. Some have already launched a legal challenge against Bill C-5 as well as Ontario's Bill 5. Carney's Bill C-5, also called the Building Canada Act, allows his government to sidestep laws and fast-track approvals for big energy and infrastructure projects that are in the national interest. The summit, attended by hundreds of First Nations leaders, was called after Carney's government faced a backlash from chiefs who said their concerns were not being respected. But he also promised them they would be able to help build the prosperity for their communities for generations to come. The National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, Cindy Woodhouse-Nepenak, was conciliatory in her assessment of the summit.
"We want to stand up for Canada against illegal tariffs. At the same time, of course, we look to make sure that no more colonialism happens within our own country. We push back on that, and just lots of work to do. And I think that we can do that by working together."
Nepenak says the issues will not be settled with one meeting, and she called for more, including a national summit of First Nations leaders with the Prime Minister. Terry Teagee is a regional chief of the British Columbia Assembly of First Nations. He says he's still on the fence.
"Still a trust issue in the way the development of the actual legislation, and we see it in British Columbia as well in terms of Bill 1415, is this trust us mentality in this legislation. And as many First Nations know, that we do have trust issues with all levels of government, and that's why we wanted to be included from the start.
Much of the day was spent in panel-style discussions on meaningful consultations and economic prosperity. Carney and his cabinet ministers stayed all day, doing more listening than talking. Some chiefs said they could work with the prime minister, while others said they still need more convincing. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Former Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez declared his second bid for Congress Tuesday, setting up a rematch for a House seat in northeastern Arizona. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has more on why Nez is running again.
Before this announcement, Nez admittedly mulled over launching another campaign, aiming to replace his tribal successor, Navajo Nation President Boo Nigrin. The next presidential election takes place in 2026.
Folks from the Navajo Nation wanted us to come home and be their president again. And it was a tough decision. But my family decided, you know, that this is the best way to help bring unity throughout the country. And of course, Congress should look like America.
Nez is vying to become Arizona's first indigenous congressman. In a statement, his opponent, Republican Congressman Eli Crane, said the Democratic Party has hit rock bottom by letting Nez challenge him again. He lost to Crane last year by a 9% margin, some 36,000 votes, in the state's largest congressional district by size, which is home to more than a dozen federally recognized tribes. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
U.S. senators from New Mexico and Colorado have introduced the Tribal Access to Clean Water Act, which invests in tribal water projects. The bill increases funding through the Indian Health Service, the Department of Agriculture, and the Bureau of Reclamation to support water infrastructure and help provide clean water to Native American households that currently lack access. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
In a development that has drawn renewed attention to the Epstein case, sources reveal that Attorney General Pam Bondi informed President Donald Trump about his name appearing in the Epstein files as early as this spring. This information comes amidst a broader re-examination of the case by FBI agents and prosecutors. The disclosure included Deputy Attorney General Todd Blantz, who, along with Bondi, briefed Trump on the findings related to the high-profile figures connected to Epstein, information not previously made public. President Trump has maintained that he was friends with the disgraced financier until a falling out in the 2000s. In February, Bondi distributed binders concerning the Epstein files, which contained personal contact information for Trump's former wife and daughter. In a statement addressing inquiries about the briefing, Bondi and Blantz said, quote, "As part of our routine briefing, we made the president aware of the findings. Nothing in the files warranted further investigation or prosecution," end quote. White House Communications Director Stephen Chung has consistently avoided questions regarding Trump's relationship with Epstein, labeling suggestions of wrongdoing as fake news. Chung also noted that Trump had expelled Epstein from Mar-a-Lago for being a creep. Officials within the Justice Department have kept White House personnel informed about the developments in the Epstein inquiry, a practice permissible under the law. A source close to President Trump indicated that neither the president nor White House officials were particularly concerned about the latest disclosures, given that Trump's name had already surfaced in prior reports. In a landmark advisory opinion published today, the International Court of Justice, or ICJ, said countries must actively prevent harm to the climate system, and that failing to do so could result in paying compensation and other forms of restitution. The ICJ president, Yuji Awasawa, said climate breakdown has severe and far-reaching consequences, saying, quote, These consequences underscore an urgent, existential threat. The opinion covers a wide range of matters under international law, explicitly aiming at fossil fuels, saying that a state's failure to take appropriate action to protect the climate system may constitute an international wrongful act attributed to that state. The court also said that states are legally liable
for the actions of the private sector and must regulate corporate activities that contribute to the climate crisis. The UN instructed the ICJ to produce the union in 2023 after years of campaigning from a group of Pacific Island law students led by the Pacific Island state of Vanuatu. It is the largest case that court has ever heard. During a two-week hearing in The Hague last year, representatives of vulnerable states told a panel of 15 judges that countries should be held legally responsible for the impacts of the climate crisis. The world's top greenhouse gas emitters denied they had any obligations beside the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change and the 2015 Paris Agreement. The ICJ resoundingly rejected that argument, saying a range of other treaties applied, as well as customary international law, which includes principles of sustainable development, intergenerational equity, and common but differentiated responsibilities. The court said a clean, healthy, and sustainable environment was a precondition for all human rights, and that the climate crisis being a global problem does not absolve individual states of responsibility. The ICJ is the third of the four top courts to publish such a document on the climate crisis, having the widest jurisdiction and the role of harmonizing and integrating international law.
Smoke plume from January wildfires near Los Angeles carried lead for miles. Hazardous lead levels, the product of incinerated paint and pipes, have been found far from the fire's edge. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When wildfires hit Altadena, California this past January, François Tissot's home survived mostly intact. But he's since found a new danger